Okay, thank you, Maud. So yes, I'm doing the PhD in physics actually at the University of Innsbruck. And together with Maud and Sarah, I'm doing this project on AI in the scientific discovery. And today I'm going to talk about our work on interpreting the outcome of an artificial intelligence assistant in science. And I will frame this work on the context of the book on techno-scientific practices. So let's, I can use this actually. Good. This is the title of the book, as you know already, Techno-Scientific Practices and Informational Approach by Federica, who is here, and I'm really happy and at the same time feel a little bit of pressure. So if I say something philosophically wrong, just please interrupt me. Also, for the rest of the people in the audience, you can feel free to ask me any questions during the talk. And I'm going to do a little bit of a recap now after lunch so that everyone is in the same spot. So the idea of the book is to combine philosophy of technology with philosophy of science and in the context of a practice-based philosophy. And this last part is the one that resonated more with me because, of course, like I do the practical part. So I felt really into all of these notions. And then the framework is in general this epistemological setup where we have the world, we have also the epistemic agents and the instruments and these interrelationships that circle around the notion of knowledge. And her exercise is focusing more onto the epistemic agents. And moreover, what she does is this exercise of just shifting all the perspective and including inside the epistemic agents, both human and artificial. And in the relation of with respect to the world is via this construction of knowledge. And that's why knowledge, I haven't put it just around floating as before, but just really in this notion of relationship. And important too, the two important things are this idea of poiesis that we already saw this morning, so I don't need to go over it, and also the constructionism perspective. And now that I have already set up the scene, I would present this work on automated gadget discovery in science, and I will frame it inside this philosophical context, focusing more into the poiesis part, also the notion of model and the notion of evidence. And in this work that we do, you will see how the relationship between an AI epistemic agent and the human epistemic agent will play a fundamental role, and the environment will be a scientific one. Okay, so now I'm going to present you with the context that this work was based on. And this is the context of AI-driven science. So basically how we can develop AI assistants and maybe in the future full AI scientists that help us do science in some way. And in the past years, we have seen, as you see here, a lot of works really that are pushing this development of algorithms to help us do science and to do this scientific discovery on their own. A huge breakthrough was AlphaFold, that was this algorithm that correctly predicted the protein structures. That was a thing or a process that took entire research groups to do and experiments and a lot of really work. And these algorithms were able to do in a very short amount of time. Then we also have these examples of self-driving laboratories in which they try to automate the full process. So they have a machine learning algorithm combining with these robotic arms that you see here in order to automate the full loop of the discovery. We also see here the work that Sarah was mentioning before on how our group, together with some group in Vienna, develop this machine learning algorithm that learns to create new quantum experiments. And actually the work I'm going to present today is like a follow-up of this work. And also in the context of physics in general, we have this AI Feynman, that it's a physics-inspired method for symbolic regression. So we see that there have been already a lot of progress in this area. And now I'm going to come back to the philosophical context. So I will be doing this all through the talk, so like presenting first the physics part, if you want, and then trying to relate it to the notions that we have been seeing this morning. And in particular, I want to start with the idea of poiesis, which is the concept that encapsulates the key aspects of knowledge production. So it's this idea that knowledge is created, as Federica was explaining this morning. I'm going to go a little bit quick here because she already had like one slide that was exactly this. So the semantic space of poiesis includes the poetic character of human epistemic agents, the production of artifacts by us, the production of knowledge by us, and this notion of human epistemic agents as technoscientists and philosophers. And I want to emphasize in the last 2 points, so the poetic character of artificial agents. And I'm going to focus in this talk on AI agents, so really artificial intelligence, and how they interact and modify the environment, and they have this extra notion of learning via this interaction. And the last point, which is really the one that I'm going to focus on in this talk, is this partnership between human and artificial epistemic agents in the process of knowledge production. And with this, I want to emphasize as well this this idea coming from philosophy of information. And I would like to say that many of these notions that come from philosophy of information in the book really resonated a lot with me, because especially coming from AI, somehow it fits really well with how I see these systems process the world around them. And I will quote here, so what is at stake is the ability to process information, which since the fourth revolution is not a unique feature to us humans anymore, as we have already seen with AI. In fact, there are plenty of artifacts that can process information, from, of course, simple personal computers or calculators to sophisticated AI algorithms. And this makes them legitimate epistemic agents. So from this point, I'm going to really take these definitions, and I'm going to start already considering these AI assistants in science as AI epistemic agents, because they are able to do this processing of information, plus they have this characteristic that they learn. And this gives already more autonomy. I don't want to go full into the philosophical debate, but I will just say that this gives us more autonomy than other non-learning instruments or methods. And this precisely this autonomy that changes our role in the scientific practice. And taking up Floridi's classification on technologies, we have first-order technologies in which humans access nature via some form of technology, like for instance the telescope would be something like this. Second order technology in which humans via some technology interact with another technology, like you can imagine the remote control to control the television. And I'm going to now focus on this last part, which is the third order technology, like AI systems, in which as you see, it's already like a technology interacting with a technology and another one. So as you see, like humans have already been taken out of this chain, which so you will see how in the project this is really clear, but at the same time it's going to become clear as well that even though humans are not part of this process, they really need to be involved in some way. Okay, and I'm going to present a very specific example of what I mean. Okay, so the main challenge in AI-driven science is really if we are going to be able to understand what these AI systems produce. And this leads automatically to notions on interpretability and explainability in AI. That is also a field that nowadays is really being pushed forward. And again, back, this relates to this interaction between human and artificial epistemic agents. So with that, I've already set all the context to present the work. And the work is called Automated Gadget Discovery in Science, together with Lea Trenkwalder, Henrik Pulsenautrup, Fulvio Flamini, and Hans Riegel from the University of Innsbruck. And the idea is that we develop an algorithm towards explainable AI for science. In particular, we consider reinforcement learning, which is a machine learning method in which we have an agent that learns a policy by interacting with the environment. The policy really defines the behavior of the agent, and mathematically it's a probability distribution between the states that the agent perceives and the actions that the agent is going to make. This interaction with the environment in reinforcement learning is very precise, and it has this form. So on the one hand, we have the agent, and on the other hand, we have the environment. And these are two different things that are somehow coded separately, and they interact in this process. So the environment gives some state that the agent perceives, and then the agent performs an action on the environment. And depending on whether this action was correct or not under some task that we give them, the environment issues a reward. And the agent takes this reward and updates the policy with this reward, okay? So that, for example, if the agent did something correctly, it will enhance the probability of doing the same thing again the next time it perceives the same state. And this is the basics of reinforcement learning, but what we did in this work is really to provide a full framework that consists of three parts. First, we have this reinforcement learning in which the agent learns via these interactions that I've said before. And then once the agent has learned, we extract some data from its behavior, and we add an extra algorithm that is data mining in order to extract some patterns from the behavior of the agent so that we are able to learn what the agent has learned. So basically to interpret which are the things that the agent is doing more often, for example, in this thing that we don't know that it has learned. And additionally, we have added a third part, which is this clustering in order to classify those gadgets. Okay, so now let's go piece by piece. So the first part, as I've said before, is exploring the task environment and learning. And the learning, and now it's going to be a problem, the learning consists of several episodes. This is reinforcement learning terminology. And in one episode, the agent can have several of these interactions that I've mentioned before, in which an interaction is this tuple of state action reward. Below here, you have more state action reward, okay? State action reward. And then the learning consists of many episodes. And what we do is we wait until the agent learns. And then we, when the agent has already succeeded in the task, we stop, and then we collect what the agent is doing. So we let it do stuff, basically, but no learning this time. And then we collect a data set of rewarded sequences. So things that the agent is doing, so these interactions that we see here, that are already successful. Because we want to interpret the policy of the agent. We want to interpret what the agent has learned. And then each data point in this data set is a sequence of actions. So it's important, the notion of the sequence here. Basically, yeah, you don't see here, but here you see A0, A1, A2, and so on. These are the sequential actions that the agent has performed in one episode. And this will be one data point of this data set, okay? And then we will have many of these. So once we have collected this data set of sequences, we go to part two, which is distilling these gadgets. And this algorithm, what it does is it selects the subsequences that are more often used by the agent, okay? Subsequences, I mean, so if this is one sequence, the subsequence will be A1, A3, okay? So these subsequences that are frequently used, and that they are also compact. So meaning that these two elements are really close together, okay? And then finally, we consider interestingness, which is the two things combined. So for us, a gadget will be a subsequence that the agent is using a lot, so like frequently and compactly, So that this subsequence is really, the elements go one after the other, basically. You can imagine it that way. And then once we have the gadgets, we realize that we needed something more for this interpretation, and we classify them depending on the context in which the agent used them, okay? And then by context, we really mean the observation before the gadget is placed. So what has the agent seen before placing that gadget, okay? So basically then we will have in one cluster all the gadgets that the agent used in the same context, and in a different context, all the other gadgets. And this really actually helped a lot in interpreting what the agent has learned. Okay, and now I'm going to provide an example that is a testbed that we use for checking, like to check the algorithm. And we have done so in two different environments, but I don't have time for both, so I just picked one. And this one is on quantum information processing. So I'm going to go over this without giving details and just providing very, very intuitive and not accurate ideas on the thing. So the idea is that the agent builds quantum circuit, okay? A depiction of a quantum circuit is the one that you see here. Each line depicts one qubit, okay? The qubit is the main unit of quantum information. You don't need to understand anything, just follow what I'm trying to do here. Then the time direction goes from left to right, okay? And then the quantum information, we are assuming that it enters here through the first qubit, okay? Then we can just play around with this information by doing certain operations that are called gates. These are these green squares that you see here. And also other types of transformation of the information that are measurements, okay? And you see that this can be in the form of two qubit gates and measurements, or one qubit gates and measurements, okay? You just need to imagine it as you place this thing and this thing transforms the information, and this is the goal you want in a quantum information processing. Okay, good. The idea for the agent is that in one episode, the agent builds one circuit. The initial circuit that the agent sees has this form, so the environment already randomly picks three operations that can be measurements of gates and place them here. And this is the initial state that is given to the agent, and then the agent is tasked to fill it, to complete it. Okay, so to just add here as actions, like one qubit gate, two qubit gates, whatever, whatever. Okay, interspersed between the actions of the environment. But there is some condition, of course, and that is that the task is to keep the quantum information alive. And this is going to define the reward function. So again, I'm going to be here super just inaccurate, but just to so that for you to build some intuition and get the idea of the thing. So in quantum information, and in general in quantum mechanics, the measurements transform the state. So it's not really that you have the thing there and you check what's going on, but really the measurements have some impact on the state. And with this idea, the problem here, or a problem, like what's going on in the quantum information processing, is that a measurement can destroy the quantum information. So if the quantum information enters here, these are the three initial gates or measurements, and then the agent, for instance, places some gate there, it can happen that if there is a measurement here, then the information does something like this, and then it's destroyed there. Okay, so then the reward will be negative because the agent has not been able to do anything about it, okay? But of course, there are certain strategies, some operations that the agent can do in order to teleport the quantum information, okay? So for instance, in here, we see that the agent has done something else, so has put some other two qubit gates. That what this may do is just do something like this, in which the information is kind of distributed. And then by this distribution, when the measurement comes, the information has already been able to be teleported to a different register. And in that sense, it has dodged somehow the measurement. This is all really super vague, okay? And not super accurate, but I hope that you get the idea. So the idea is that the agent is able to do something, okay, to somehow circumvent this initial measurement there. And this will give you will give the agent a positive reward. Of course, I want to emphasize here that this is a testbed. So as Sarah was saying before, we are experts on these things. We know how it works, and we know the fundamental notions behind how quantum circuits work. So what we do is really to test the explainability of the algorithm and to see what the agent comes out with, and then to see if we are able to understand it. Okay, good. Then something like this will be already positive because there is no measurement, so the agent just needs to learn not to mess it up with measurements, for example. Okay, and then in this very specific context, a gadget will look something like this, so a combination of, for example, these two operations that the agent has learned to always place and place together. Okay, I hope so far so good. If there are any questions, please feel free to ask. And then these are the results. So I'm going to do as we always do, of this is what comes out. on the one hand, we see some clusters here in which we have all the gadgets that the agent used when there was nothing to avoid, so to say. Okay, there are here no measurements on the first register, which is where the is flowing in. So then the agent just places whatever, like these gates that are okay for not messing up the circuit. And then interestingly, we found that there is another cluster here that clustered all the gadgets that the agent learned to use when actually there was something going on here already from the beginning. So the agent needed to do something, okay, to dodge this problem. And then in this cluster, we found all of these gadgets together, which of course helped us a lot in this interpretability of what the agent has learned to do. Okay, and with this, I'm going now to shift. So I hope you understood what the project was about. And now I'm going to try to explain this from the point of view of the philosophy of the techno practice. So instead of just showing the output, I'm going to go a little bit into how we developed it and what our practice was in this interaction with the AI. For that, I'm going to focus on the notion of model. And I have picked two notions from the book. First, model as a representation of a phenomenon in a formal way, like, for instance, probability distributions. And I want to hint here at what I thought could be something, and is that the agent learns to adjust its policy, which is, in fact, a probability distribution, to succeed in the task. And then I put this question out there, is it indirectly building its own model by just developing this policy? Or maybe we need something else, no, to call this a model. And on the other side, I picked this notion of model as an epistemic object. And here I want to focus on how we develop a model of the phenomenon. And in this case, how we access this agent's policy, and through this interpretability work, we are able to interpret it and help us model some phenomenon. So this is the goal, right? That the agent performs something, some scientific practice, and we, by interpreting this learning process, we are able to model this phenomenon with the help of AI. But of course, for that, we need this production to be interpretable. Okay, and then, yes, and then of course here I put a lot of emphasis in this interaction between epistemic agents as being really central to the modeling process, because it's, for me, it's an example of how by interacting with the AI, we are really enabling this modeling production of the phenomenon. And if this wants to move, yeah. And with that, I want to shift to model validation. So what does it mean for a model to be valid? And I quote here, a model is valid to the extent that the scientist, the practitioner, or the human epistemic agent can tell the whole story about model building and model testing, and this story holds up to scrutiny. I picked this sentence because it really, I felt that this is how it is, because in our case, it was through the process of building this framework that I've explained, we went through this thing. So we went through this process of do we understand what the AI is outputting? And if not, then maybe we should add something else. So that's why the algorithm has these three parts, because we started adding one part, which is this data mining. Then we thought, maybe this is not enough, and I'm going to show you here something that is for sure not a final result, but I wanted to show it to you just that as a proof of what I'm saying, because this was the list of gadgets before the clustering. Okay, for sure we can tweak this a little bit to get less of them, but what I'm saying here is just that even for us, that we already understand the environment and we are quantum physicists and so on, it was hard to see this thing. It was hard for us to interpret what was going on here. And it is not the case that the agent is being unsuccessful. No, no. So here the agent is really performing well. So it's really being able to correctly build these quantum circuits. It's just that we are not able to understand exactly why it's working or what the agent is doing. So this was the idea of the, this was the result of the gadgets before the clustering. So we knew that we needed to add something else. So that's why this whole story, this whole, being able to tell the whole story for me was really, really on point. And then from modeling, I'm going to jump into evidence and on the role of epistemic agent in evidence generation. And again, I always pick like notions from philosophy of information because for AI, I think they really match. And in this case, it's Floridi's definition of information, where P is an instantiation of information understood as semantic context, if and only if P consists of data. This, of course, we have seen. Data in P are well formed, so I've shown you that we already got even gadgets. And three, well-formed data are meaningful. And that was, for instance, the key point to us on this plot that I just showed you, that it's just, it was not meaningful to us or not meaningful enough, okay? And this is where we, for instance, added the clustering because it helped us really understand the agent's policy. And I cannot read the quote from here, but I will read it from here. So epistemic agents attach meaning to the data. Thus, data acquire meaning in the context of modeling practice that generates them, and depending on the specific research questions, background theories, or any other relevant element that scientists or epistemic agents use. And again, like this really fits our own practice, because this is how it went. So really, we are the ones attaching meaning to the data that we got, and we are the ones interpreting AI systems. So it really needs to be able to be meaningful to us. And the final, I'm going to end with this final quote from the book that builds up on this notion of Floridi's information, of evidence as semantic information. So if a number or a graph counts as evidence, it is because it carries semantic content for some epistemic agent. And this semantic content is given by this network of relations that we can specify using this general definition of information. So I hope that I was able to provide a good example of a techno-scientific practice in which I tried at least to take all the notions that I found relevant or that resonated with me from the book and connected them to the work. So as a summary, so we set up the scene with the philosophy from Federica. And with a focus on epistemic agents, and especially on how artificial, and in this case AI, and human co-produce knowledge. And I presented this work on automated guided discovery in science, which was a framework for us human scientists to interpret the production of these AI systems in science. And I related it, or I hope I could relate it, to the Rousseau's philosophy. So with that, I finish. And ready for discussion. Thank you.
Very nice, Andrea. I mean, it's nice that it makes sense in the actual practice, yes. And not the one that I picked in the book. So, as you may know, we are writing a chapter with Sarah and two other PhD students from Amsterdam, because a colleague of mine is trying to to develop a philosophy of science for machine learning. And so he had given me the task of answering the question whether, because we use increasingly these machine learning techniques, it means that human will be displaced in the scientific inquiry. And so I started this conversation with these two PhD students that actually do machine learning in two different contexts. And then Sarah came to Amsterdam and we had this conversation. So she joined this writing group, etc. But then I think this is exactly the question for you. But because from what you presented, I think that the question is there. I mean, I think implicitly you answered, no, we are never displaced. But I would like to see how you see it.
Yeah. So I think it really depends on who you ask. Because, so for me, no. For me, this will be, again, because for me, science is always for us. So for us in the sense of, for us, because we are the ones wanting to understand the world. Yeah. And as I see it personally, then I think we will always need, as I told you before, this process of get into a phenomenon and like dealing with it. And for that, I see these AI systems as, of course, of huge help. And it can help in many, they can help in many different ways, like AlphaFold, for example. And they can hint at new physics or new chemistry or new whatever. But I don't think that we will ever be out of the loop. I mean, because then what's the point? Like, if they are just prompters, for me, I don't see it that way, because if they are just prompters that we ask, like oracles that we just ask, I think we will always need this process of getting to the phenomenon and manipulating it in some way. But it's true that we have had as well 1 week recently, like some months ago, where we were exploring this natural language processing models and so on. And we were a little bit negative. So we were like, okay, if these are going to become super powerful and they are going to do everything, then maybe we should just, instead of studying quantum physics, we should maybe study natural language models to be able to better interact with them. And then in the end, they are going to just do the physics. And then we really need to learn more about how to interact with them and how to develop them, rather than focusing on I don't know, learning quantum mechanics. But I personally think that this is a little too extreme, because of this, because I think we need this process.
But then two things, Andrea. So one is that the first part of your answer to me. Now, then I would like to go back to one of your initial slides where you had all the titles of these published papers.
Yes.
And then you may want to object about how they are pitching the results. They are probably communicating something that is, if not misleading, but clearly they are trying to be provocative in how much the AI is achieving on its own, forgetting kind of all these elements of interaction that instead you showed. And this goes back to what we were saying yesterday over dinner, you know, how we communicate the results does not always correspond to the process of getting to the results, and we may want to emphasize some things more than others. That is one thing. The other thing, you come back to the problem of large language models, and I guess this is where the model of the in-betweenness is, in a sense, very simplistic in character, because clearly the humans may be in different places and in different roles. So if you are using the large language model in the context of a scientific experiment in quantum mechanics, then you feel that the large language model is doing a lot without you, okay? But somebody has been kind of the designer of this large language model, and actually not just one person. So somewhere in the chain, humans are there, and the problem is whether you need to get contact with this group of humans or whether you can just work with the technology independently of this human interaction, for instance.
Yeah, okay, so for the first thing, yes. Course, but I think that this is anyway something that we do, because we also need titles that get attention. And yes, of course. And sometimes the titles are really, I don't know, overselling a little bit. Yes, of course. But somehow, like, I think within the community of people that develop these algorithms, everyone somehow knows where we stand, and we are able to place those findings as really for what they are. And of course, for us, it's also really surprising. And we saw AlphaFold, that it was like, oh my God, look what this thing was able to do. And so it already had some surprising factor to us. But I understand that maybe we should be a little bit more careful, because for the general public, for example, maybe we are hyping it too much. And then this, on the long run, probably is not beneficial for us or for anyone, actually, because of this thing. Yes, and then with respect to the second thing, what was the second thing again? Sorry.
The technology.
Yes. So with respect to that, I wouldn't actually put the focus on, yeah, the algorithm first was developed by people, because somehow this, I think when it becomes like used by everyone, so like we also use computers now, and nobody's thinking like, yeah, well, but a computer was built by a person. I think the focus should be more on how we do this process. So how much we intervene in the process. Like what this thing of that I was saying before, that at least among the discussions that I had with my colleagues, there seems to be like people that think like, yeah, I maybe don't care. I will just use it as a prompter or as an oracle. I will ask that thing questions, and that thing is going to answer me full answers. And maybe that thing is able to access more of nature, if you want, and gain or build a larger model of nature than we are going to be able to do. Again, for me, as I personally see it, I think we need this process. And of course, we can prompt them and so on, but I believe that we will always want to do the process of, like, I don't know. So that's why I love your ideas on materiality and stuff, because for me it's also this way of like manipulating and checking, and this thing doesn't fit to me because of some intuition, so that I take it and I move it and I change different things of an equation, for example, and then this is what gives me more intuition and what helps me get more knowledge. It's not just that when I have been given things, then I know, because this is not how you do science, really. So, but this is again my personal perspective, so maybe if you ask a different person.
Any other questions?
Okay, then I have one, finally. I was wondering if you then have the results of the gadget mining, and could you as a scientist then actually use it? Like, how do you now have these clusters of gadgets,
yeah,
and at least one of them also involves a measurement process.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what does that tell you anything? Was this a result that you expected, or?
So this depends on how you see it, right? So you can see it as, we already know these things. So this is, since we know, this is like hinting at, okay, if this already explains me more and I'm able to relate to what I know, then it means for us that the interpretability part is enough to some extent. To some extent, because we still don't believe that this is just the end of the story. But okay, to some extent. Of course, you can also imagine, like, what if we don't know anything, no? Like, imagine that I don't really know that this goes, that this happens in quantum mechanics. At least, of course, like, this is not full-blown thing, because I still believe that if you are given this and you have no clue on quantum mechanics, so imagine you don't know anything, then, of course, this doesn't give you the full story. But at least I think it points you to some direction, because it's already saying like, hey, there are some things here that are different from these things and that are different from these things. So then maybe I look more on this, right? And then you are able to, because we, this is what I have put in here, but we are able to access the full context. Okay, so the machine can output all of the states that were the states that the agent perceived before placing the gadgets. So you can see those. And then you will also be able to see, huh, like there is something going on here. All of these things have some similarity, which of course this is the idea behind the clustering algorithm, okay? These are similar. This is how it clusters, by notions of similarity. But when we see this already points us to some direction, okay? And this already tells us, like, okay, there is, these gadgets are used in this context, but not in here. And then you will see, hey, and then what is special about this?
And what is it then that you have gained out of this? Is this then that you will learn other new agents, you will give them these tools and then say, okay, now you can build forth on this? Mm-hmm. Or does it tell us something about us?
Both. So we started the project actually by the first thing you said, because there is also one thing called hierarchical learning, which is precisely that. So the agent first learns some tools or gadgets that are subsequences, and then you can give those to another agent to see if then this agent learns more or better or learns more hierarchies up from these tools to make these tools more complex, for example. But then, of course, we can also, and this is how we placed our work at the moment, in the sense of interpretability, okay? This we used to interpret the policy of the agent. Because for us, it's like not enough that the agent is able to learn these things, but we really want to understand what's going on, because yes, so the agent learns a policy and it's perfect, good, but then there is like no way that if you have this probability distribution over states and actions, if the states are a lot and the actions are a lot, like there is no way that you see this table and you find something out of there. And then in that sense, this helps.
So what you have found then is if you try to interpret the output of such an agent,
yes,
you need to first establish a context. Otherwise, there's no way to go about it.
Yeah, both. So we first do the distilling of the gadgets.
Yeah.
So this,
yeah,
finding frequent subsequences, and then also like the context. So
and
where?
And what's then a context to you?
So we have a very, of course, very explicit thing, which is just for us, the states that the agent perceived before placing the gadget.
Ah, yeah.
So this is what you see here, okay? In here, in this square, is where the agent placed this particular gadget. And this is one example of a circuit that is within this context of this cluster. So this is one state in which the agent perceived this thing and said, ha, now I put this gadget here because I'm seeing whatever here. No. Okay, this is a state.
Yes.
And this is the action.
Yes.
The agent perceives this thing and has to make a decision. What should I do with this circuit? Then the agent learned to place this gadget here.
Ah, yeah.
And this gadget particularly saves the quantum information when there is a measurement here and moves it around, teleports it around. So then all of these states in which the agent is doing this thing of teleporting are clustered together.
Yes.
And this is the cool thing we found, like that there are clustered together in one thing, and then all of these gadgets that the agent used to teleport are together in one thing. So then if you never knew about teleportation, at least when you are given this cluster, it gives you some hint, like, hey, that something is going on here. Of course, we are not claiming anything more than this. So we are not claiming, I don't know, that this is full interpretable and full whatever. We are just saying like, okay, this is like one step further.
Cool.
Thank you, Andrea. It's really nice to see how it developed.
Yeah, because you saw the beginning.
Maybe to go back to the previous discussion about hard coding versus freedom.
Yeah.
How much did you give the agent before you left it to this thing. So was the only target it had just to not lose the quantum information, or what was?
Yes.
So what was the reasoning behind what you give the agent with it on the journey?
Yes. So from all of these parts that I've shown here, the learning is here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is not learning, and this is also not learning. I mean, not learning in that strict sense. Okay. And in here, in this particular testbed of the quantum info processing environment, we picked a reward function that was super general.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, super, super general. This thing of like keep the quantum information alive is really the most general
thing. Yes, okay.
And we picked that kind of on purpose because we wanted to put something very general as if in playing the we don't know really how much mm-hmm. it is in there, so we didn't want to embed a lot of knowledge that mm-hmm. we had into the reward function already to see how the agent played around with the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing. Then, of course, in here, for example, in the data mining, the user can pick several parameters. So we can pick what's the minimum. So in here, let me see. In here, we can pick what's the minimum support we demand for a gadget to be a gadget. We can pick what's the minimum cohesion we demand for a gadget to be a gadget.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on this criterion that we put, then the algorithm will output one thing or the other. But the learning is just on the reinforcement learning, and mm-hmm. then the other two parts belong to this post hoc interpretability addition that we put.
Yes.
Yeah.
The only question that I have, so you do first the learning, they extract the gadgets.
Yes.
But then you decided, okay, now we have this graph, you know, that it's not clear. So we need to cluster in some way.
Yes.
And my question is just what are the conditions for these clusters? Like, did you see that all the a large part of the gadgets all had then this context, or did you first construct the context, and what was your construction of this context based on?
Yes, no, it's not that we saw something. No. It was really that we saw that we had a long list of things that we didn't know how to deal with them. And then the idea was just really, so we first came up with the idea of classifying by context, because it's, if you think about it, it's kind of natural, right? Because you think like, okay, the agent is learning to do something. And then for us to interpret what it does, it will be useful to understand what's the decision based on.
Yeah.
Like, what is the agent seeing in order for it to decide what to put in there?
Yeah.
And is there a difference between these states that the agent sees? Can we classify then the gadgets that it puts based on where or when it decided to put them? And then we had this idea. Then with this idea, we thought, okay, then we need to classify the gadgets based on the observations.
Yeah.
On the states the agent perceives before deciding.
Sure.
And these states are what we called context. Okay, so then we developed an algorithm, and this is done automated manner. Okay, so this is done with another algorithm. And then we don't do this.
Okay.
The algorithm, what it does is takes first all the states, a full list of states on which this gadget was used. Next gadget. Another full list of all the states in which the gadget was used, and so on and so forth with all the gadgets. Then it computes a similarity measure, actually. So we transform this into, imagine, I don't know, a list of ones and zeros, okay? And then we can compute a similarity measure between all these states for each gadget. We call this initialization set. And then each initialization set will have a measure, and we can compute a metric between the different sets of the different gadgets. And then with that, we plug in a clustering algorithm that what it does is in an automated manner, select those initialization sets or context that are similar, but similar with a very precise mathematical formulation. And then these gadgets are clustered together in an automated manner. How do you say that?
Automated.
Okay. Yes. So it's not us, eh? It's not us doing this. No.
Okay, but that's great. Okay, so you still give a kind of, you give the idea, then you have this idea, then you build another algorithm.
Yes.
And the algorithm helps you select this similarity. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
So I'm understanding now, I think, what the relationship is here between your agent and the context and the gadgets it's placing, and that essentially it's being given full information about the environment it's it's acting upon. And I'm curious what would happen or how you think we might move these agents to a place where if you hid something of the context from the agent, would it be able to place gadgets that would help it find what that hidden piece of information is and act accordingly?
Okay, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but in the learning process, the agent is able to generalize. I don't know if this is what you're hinting at or not really, but it's not that the agent learns for each possibility what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we actually at every time, because these initial states are random. Okay, so then at every time the agent needs to cope with something that in some cases it has never seen before. Okay, and this, for that we use deep learning actually, and then this algorithm was able to generalize in order to really build good circuits starting from things that it has never seen before. Is this really what you were hinting at, or not really?
But what I think maybe the better way of me phrasing it is, would the sequential nature of the agent's actions allow it to differentiate between contexts that looked the same on its first pass but behaved differently based on its actions? Imagine in this C2, this bottom red measurement square, right? It exists in the way that the environment behaves in response to the agent's gadgets, but the agent does not perceive that red square, right? Maybe there's another context that also has a measurement somewhere else in the, what did you call this? The levels of...
The registers.
The registers, right? And so the agent would have to sequentially make interventions to differentiate between contexts that look the same but behave differently based on its interventions.
But I think I believe that this is actually what's going on.
Okay.
Because the agent does this process, where do I have it? Sequentially. So the agent first perceives these three things, mm-hmm. places one thing, mm-hmm. so action A0, mm-hmm. then it perceives the next state, and the next state is then the circuit with this plus this. Mm-hmm. Then it performs this next action, so this one, and then again.
I see. And
okay, so it
because it doesn't already know what the combination of these three things it's perceiving is going to do.
Exactly, yes.
It is looking already for this hidden information.
I don't want to interpret too much, but I would say yes. So like, it's kind of, yes. So the state is also updating.
Mm-hmm.
So the agent, as it builds a circuit, the states it perceives change.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is this interaction process. So it's, in some sense, I would say yes.
Okay.
Okay, it's maybe not so much a question than a remark. So the difference between the large language models that we talked about earlier in the discussion here and this one is that I think I've heard it said that the large language models are actually already plateauing because these people have already used all available text that is out there to train these models, right?
Really?
So, I mean, they are spectacular, but they have basically gobbled up everything that has ever been written. And maybe you can scan a few more books, but basically they are already trained on everything that is out in writing. Whereas here, you can always do something new because it's not a pre-given thing. So this is very interesting. I think it really highlights the difference between reinforcement learning and the other learning paradigms that I mostly use to train the large language model. So I find this very interesting. And this is in a way much more open-ended. That's all I wanted to say.
And this is where I don't know.
I mean, I don't know for sure either, but I can imagine that actually, because there's not so much out there in terms of written text, right?
But then the question for me really is how much these models are then going to be able to transform already this information.
Yeah.
And this is why I was already like think like when I read this section on the models, on this notion of manipulation, that for us it's kind of, or for me at least, it's kind of very natural because I find that this is what I do. Or what we do, like we check, we tweak this, we see what happens if we tweak this, we tweak there, and I don't know, we have this thing. But I don't know if these big models will be able to tweak in such a way.
Exactly, yeah.
And this is something I really don't know. Yeah. And it depends on who you ask, but I'm really, really not sure. Because then there is like this work where they put a lot of these natural language models in a video game kind of type of thing, like The Sims, for instance, and then you have several of them, and then they are given like just one basic prompt that is organize a party or something, and each of them has their own setup in the sense of like you are a doctor that works in whatever, and then you are whatever. And then with only this prompt of organize a party, they build, it's a little bit scary, they build kind of relationships in the sense of like, I tell this one to come on Monday, and then depending on if the others have said yes or no, then the other one decides to go to the party or not. I don't know, I'm just saying that that maybe we don't know yet the full capacity of these things.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.